Good morning, everyone. I'm going to be talking about blogging and social media. And the subtitle of the talk was, Where Do We Go From Here? And so, because it's too early for the bar. You know, in some time zones, I'm sure it'd be fine, but at least here. You know, a lot of you are familiar with the things that I've done in terms of WordPress and Automattic and all that. And thanks to Boris's wonderful introduction. But, you know, the beginning, I was a blogger. So I'd actually like to just begin with that, go back. We're going to start with blogging. We're going to have a little mini interlude, and then we're going to end with more social media and sort of where we're going. This was me in Washington, D.C. in 2002, before WordPress existed, actually. This is where everything got started. I'd gotten a digital camera. Photomat existed. I'd had a blog before, a movable type, but it wasn't much to look at or talk about. So I'd switched to the gallery. I was doing the photos, and while in Washington, D.C., I was so inspired by the things I was seeing and what I was experiencing that I just felt like I had to share this in written form, that pictures weren't doing it justice. I needed thousands of words otherwise. At the time, you know, WordPress didn't exist, but blogging was old. In fact, I thought I was really late to blogging. You know, there was Open Diary, LiveJournal, PETAs. You know, some of these are still around. Like Blogger is now really the largest blogging system in the world, and some have waned a little bit, such as Open Diary or PETAs, where we don't hear about very much anymore. But these started, you know, Open Diary started in 98, LiveJournal 99. These are, you know, years before blogging was even a sparkle in most people's eyes, which is why I think it's funny when I hear people say, now, I'd like to start a blog, but I feel like it's kind of done. You know, when we're almost a decade into it, and it's still not too late, I think. I think we're still at the cusp of where this is really going. Anyway, you know, long story short, I was blogging, I was frustrated with the software. B2, the software that I was using, was abandoned. And myself and a guy in England, Mike Little, started working on what was a fork of the software. It was WordPress. I don't know if any of y'all remember this design. This was actually not the first design, which was all black and white. This was when we added a splash of color. I was really excited about the blue, and it was a big deal in the community at the time. I just couldn't find, you know, that original one. But, I mean, WordPress was really rough in the beginning. And but, you know, it's important to note that it wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for the fact that B2 was open source software, that we were able to take that code and build on it, that we didn't have to start from scratch reinventing the wheel on how to do trackbacks and archives and search and all the wonderful stuff that B2 had done. That was 5 years ago. 5 years and 7.2 million downloads of WordPress. WordPress actually just had its fifth anniversary a few months ago. This astounds me, because in the beginning, I couldn't get anyone to use it. There was we literally, the first like five WordPress blogs were ones I sort of forcibly set up for my friends. Yeah, it's one of those things where it was great for the software because, you know, immediately had these people who weren't that into computers on the internet using it, so I was forced to adapt it in some ways. But it was kind of rough. Even the developers of WordPress, of the five developers we had in the beginning, or the first couple months, I think I was the only one using WordPress until, like, version one. It kind of stayed safe, which was probably smart. Anyway, in those past 5 years, I feel like I've learned a little bit about what bloggers want. So I'd like to talk about that as sort of a predecessor to where we're going, because this is, of course, very broad. I called it the blogger's hierarchy of needs. But I think that, you know, we have to know what the fundamental drivings are before we can really get going. I think the number one is expression. They want their online presence to represent themselves. And this manifests itself in almost every online medium. It manifests itself offline. Have you ever looked at, like, in a middle school, the inside of a locker? It's got like 1,000 stickers. Ever looked at a MySpace page? 1,000 stickers, but they're animated. So technology can be used for good and evil. But who can tell me what the most important thing on this page is? Ignore that it's in Spanish. What's the most important thing here? The splash of blue. We got someone for the next WordPress designer up there. Any guesses?
The box over to the right.
The box over to the right? No, not at all.
The toolbar.
The what's that?
Posts.
Nope.
That's the last one. Sorry, you're me.
Feeds?
¿Qué tal?
Hello? What's that?
The title.
The title? Nope. No. So the thing about this is the structure, like this box and the structure of it, represented what we thought was most important about WordPress. We thought it was, oh, it's about the writing, it's about that. And this is very true. But actually, I think what has been most, you know, in hindsight now that we're looking back over the past 5 years, the most important tab here was the presentation or presentation. It was the fact that people could change their designs and their themes with the click of a button. And they do many, many, many thousands of times per day. On WordPress.com, it's something like 70,000 theme previews per day, about one a second, that people are changing their theme. And that is something that we overlooked and we still overlook. But I think the importance of themes cannot be understated, because it was sort of it was what allowed people to make their online presence their own. You know, this looks the same for pretty much every WordPress blog. But what's on the front, I mean, you're not exactly a unique snowflake, but it's you can represent yourself a little bit more. Who can tell me what the most important thing on this page, besides the incredibly comely lady there? The Yankees, okay. Any other guesses? A status update?
Structure?
Blue. Yeah, they stole our design. The ads. I'll talk about the ads in a second. So in my opinion, the most important thing here is two things, actually. It's a trick question. One, the inbox. It's the mailing of the Facebook system, because Facebook essentially created email or IM, but spam-free. You know, it's trouble-free. And to some extent, you know, today, spammers are our online equivalent of terrorists. And I'm not joking. And a lot of Web 2.0 and the most successful companies are essentially arbitraging security. They're protecting you from spam, and they're able to grow in popularity. But I think actually the very most important thing on this is the view photos of Glinda. I'm not just saying that because I'm biased, yeah, obviously. But when you think about it, I think that's the killer app of Facebook. And if you look at the breakdown of page views of Facebook, a huge amount, more than half, are to photo pages and people browsing photos. When you think about this, you see a photo, everyone's labeled, you can click on their name. Let's say you came across her, you said, ooh, you click on her name, and all of a sudden you're on a profile, a structured way to talk about her that's the same for everyone, and you can view more photos of her, and then you can sort of branch out. It's an incredibly, you know, links are one of the most beautiful things in the world. And before this, Flickr's tags, I think, were the first version of this, but there's no real way to sort of serendipitously browse and stumble throughout photos. And I think that's one of the reasons that Facebook's billions of page views, a good chunk of them are from the photo app. Now, interestingly, we talked about the ads. There's a button on here that says more ads, which is like a bad marketer's wet dream. It takes you to a page of nothing but ads. But I wanted to point out something really interesting here. Look in the top right where it says Tide. 2X Ultra Tide presents America's favorite stains. Where are your favorite places in your city to enjoy stain-making moments?
W Hotel.
Wait, we're getting some suggestions. I don't want to hear them, to be honest. I don't know why Tide was. There's no point to this except that there's dangers getting into social media, and we're going to talk about Tide later. I just found this incredible. Anyway. Number two. I think that the most successful, I think public is important, that you're sharing with people. If you look at the success of platforms, the ones that have defaulted to being public have been the most successful. If you look at sort of Blogger and LiveJournal, the growth curves are radically different. If you look at how closed systems, a more recent example might be Vox, which sort of was private by default. I think there's something about the publishing where this was really counterintuitive to me, because I feel like, as a geek, I can set up an access control list, and I can set, you know, I can, for every entry, I can say, Lloyd can see this, but Andy can't see this, and you can do really fine-grained permissions. But I don't think that lends itself to viral growth. That sort of permission system actually inhibits the growth, because you don't have that sort of discovery and browsing mechanism. MySpace defaults to open for everything. Privacy is important, but I think that public and sharing should really be the default mode. I think interaction is incredibly important. How many people have it set up so whenever they get a comment on the blog, they get an email? Now raise your hands. Yeah, pretty much everyone, right? Not Boris. That's because we're not as popular as Boris, but I know I get an email for everyone. It's it's amazing, right? And there's something about, for me, the most rewarding thing, personally, just the most rewarding thing about my blog is comments, because you know, half the time I don't know what I'm saying, but my commenters do. And they often correct me. And we found that things that increase the amount of interaction that people can do in these systems, that make it easier to comment on each other, that make it easy to connect, that make it easier to follow the people who you're interacting with, can have an exponential increase on growth. I see some people sitting on the stairs. There are chairs here if you want to sort of sidle past people. Finally, validation. This was a nice way of me saying that people check their stats like crack-addled gerbils, you know, pressing the button. I think that, I know we have another presentation later on, you know, F stats make art, but
go Dave.
Go Dave. There's something really amazing that, you know, you can say, wow, I'm not just, you know, writing these words in a bottle and casting them into the ocean, that there's people reading this. Even if they're drive-by visitors from Google searching for, you know, some bizarre term that you wouldn't save to your mother, you know, they're still at your blog and they're still interacting with what you've done. And some of them come back, some of them become regular readers, and some of them interact. So I put these in order, and I think those are sort of the four things that are most important to bloggers. So what else? There was one other thing that I really noticed, and that was that form dictates writing. But what I mean by this is that if you look at the history of blogging, the tools that were prevalent at the time had a large effect on what type of blogs people were doing, what type of content they were posting, and sort of how bloggers were interacting with each other. Blogging before trackbacks and pingbacks was very different to blogging after trackbacks and pingbacks. I got some screenshots from different posting. This is actually WordPress 1.2. This is when we stopped sucking. But think how you're going to interact with this versus how you're going to interact with, say, this. This is a Tumblr interface where it's basically sort of media driven. You choose what type of thing you're going to post. It takes you to a super simple form that's usually just like a single box or two. You know, compare that. This has like 30 boxes on the page. And it's grayscale. compare that to this. This was a prologue, a theme we did, which is basically Twitter in a box. And what's been most stunning about this is that basically how we made it is, so when you go to the front page of the blog, it shows a little box there, the post. And that's it. And people who are using the prologue theme are posting, you know, many, many times more than people who don't. I think part of it's, and what we found, is that there's just something nice about seeing this really simple box with none of the clutter around it. This is, of course, true for Twitter, too, because that's where we got the idea. Right out to this. You know, this is the blogging. This is actually, you know, early Blogger was even more minimalist than this. You know, early versions actually didn't have titles. There was no title. So think how blogging is without titles. You know, look at how the things are arranged. The title's really small. You have a giant post area. There's not really, you know, this is recent, the tags and categorization. And finally, I got a little sneak peek here. This is the WordPress 2.5 interface. I think that, you know, one of the things that we consciously changed here was to try and make it easier to interact with media. And if you look above the post screen, there's some buttons there for adding media. Somewhat inspired Tumblr-like, where you'll say, I have a photo, what do I do with that? I have a video, what do I do with that? And I think this is actually going to have, you know, because what we're seeing is that people are fighting to do this now through plugins and themes. If we make it easy, blogging, the rates and the types might change. So I start with my first exhortation, as I'm going to call them. We need to remove all the friction because, and this is happening already, because when you think, you know, what if this is your blogging interface and you press a button? I've seen you press a button and instantly it's on your blog. How does that change? How does that change how we consume blogs and produce them? I think the software needs to be 100% invisible if it's working well. Because if you're thinking about it, if you're thinking about how you're going to publish, how you know, you're going to format it, how you can insert that video, it sort of takes away the purpose. And any time that you spend on that is time that you're not spending creating, which is ultimately what this is most important. I've heard a fair number of people complain. There seems to be some WordPress users here, which is cool. And yesterday I heard a number of complaints, you know, I hate upgrading all my blogs. Now, hearing this, I was not sad, because that's an awesome problem to have, that you have too many WordPress blogs, that, you know, upgrading them is a chore. It's also a very, you know, what's it called, a first world problem? Where, oh, that's a good thing to have. But, you know, that sucks, and that's something that we're changing. In WordPress 2.5, there'll be a one-click button to upgrade your plugins. You know, there's a new version of this plugin. Click, it's there. In 2.6, we're hoping to do that for the actual core software itself. I mean, these types of things are really important because you know, you shouldn't have to think about what you're running. I think that as these posting interfaces have evolved, you know, when you go from, it's sort of cyclical, when you have something like the original Blogger form, which is basically a text area, to something like the early WordPress or movable types, which is like 50 boxes on a page, back to Twitter, you know, which is a single box and even limited with characters. You know, it's still going. And what we're going to see is that the volumes of posting is going to blow all predictions. I have a number here. Can anyone guess what this number is? Like what the context is?
Per day, per minute.
So this is a very small number. This is the number of posts and pages created on WordPress.com every month. Because these, I like using hard numbers, and those are numbers that I know for certain, versus technology numbers or something. This is the size of the... Sorry. This is the size of the Wikipedia. In the, you know, 4 or 5 years it's been around. It's 2.1, the English Wikipedia, as of January, is 2.1 million articles. So we're creating, just on WordPress.com, which is probably a single-digit percentage of the blogosphere, we're creating 2 Wikipedias a month. That's a lot. I mean, when you think about that, this is an enormous amount of content that's happening. So, yeah, like I said, that's just a small slice. What's going to happen, what needs to evolve, is that, you know, there's not a shortage of information anymore. That what has to happen is we need to be able to filter things and deal with this, make things more relevant. Because, you know, I used to, actually in the beginning, I would read every single WordPress.com blog. I mean, quite literally. That stopped about like 2 weeks in, right? We used to actually have a feed for every post that I would subscribe to. We need filters. And some of that's basic stuff. Like one of the first filters we put in at the very beginning of WordPress.com was, you know, language. Because I don't want to see the posts that were in Spanish and different things. I actually don't know what KTOL means. But we need more social filters. So I'm going to take a quick interlude to make 2 public service announcements. Because I'm up here and I have your attention. It's okay. Where are you going to go, right? There's no other sessions. So I have a little icon for it, too. So the first one is somewhat professional. WordPress, not WordPress. Capitalize the P. It's my biggest pet peeve. We're actually thinking about putting it into a future version where it just does this automatically, so you won't be able to write what's on the top. It'll be like, I'm not sure if that's evil or not, though. Like if Microsoft, you know, shipped something that replaced every word evil with good. I don't know. My second one was a little more personal. I recently switched domains. So if any of you have links to photomat.net, you know, please update them to ma.tt. And I'll show you why. Because there's a guy, maybe you may have seen my business cards. They say, go to Google, type in Matt and press I'm feeling lucky. Well, there's someone who's coming after me. And he's coming up fast. This is what I'm competing with. We have music here, I believe. Y'all seen this? Really? Really? So you can link to this guy's blog, but don't use the word Matt. So basically, let me turn the volume down a little bit. I'm just going to leave that running for the rest of the presentation, actually. So this guy's name's... He's also Matt, and he has a website called Where in the Hell is Matt? And we're right now battling for position number one. And I've tried the dance, you know, I can't do it. So I need your guys' help. I mean, who can match that? See, I mean, I need all the help I can get, quite honestly. That's it for the public service announcements. Back to the web. How do I refocus this? There we go. So often, I think even in my last time I spoke at Northern Voice, I said that the Achilles heel of Web 2.0 was spam. I alluded to this earlier, that spammers are our equivalent, the online equivalent of terrorists. The things that drive people from interacting with the systems, what kills ultimately these social systems that look untoppable, is, you know, bad actors. It's You know, if you look at the decline of email, which is still the most prevalent social software that any of us use or have ever seen, email, you know, people are moving away from email to IM or Facebook or MySpace messages or something because of the spam. People are moving away from MySpace because, you know, you get that really hot 22-year-old girl in the East Bay messaging you, and she's not, you know. She wants you to buy ringtones. I found out that the hard way. This is spam. How many people have logged into Facebook and had like 100 requests, right? Yeah. It sucks. And this is, I think, Facebook's largest strategic error to date, is that the rules are very loose. And some of these applications were able to profit and get millions of users almost overnight because it's kind of like the first people who did email spam, you know? The first guy to send out, you know, the buy Viagra email probably did really, really well. And everyone else saw him and said, wow, that guy made like 10 million bucks in his underwear. And they, you know, and now we're here where we are today. This has the potential to happen here. They're cracking down on it. But anything that basically takes our attention away is spam. And I think in sort of the old world and old media, content was the most valuable thing. Now it's attention is the most valuable thing you have. The most, and it's finite. We can't increase more of it. Technology isn't going to make the days longer. The most valuable thing that each of you have is your mind share, what you're thinking at, what you're looking at every day. So my exhortation number two is that we have to respect people's time. And this is fundamental in a lot of ways. And if you think about this, I think that you could use this as your single guiding principle for almost anything that you do. If you're respecting people's time, you're creating a lot of value, you're necessarily, you know, removing all the crufts. I think that one of the things we have to do is make advertising a little more discreet. I actually have a screenshot here. So where's the content on this page? I'm sure this is a perfectly nice guy, but there's, you know, it's like, here's the post, way down here. Okay, to make up, everyone go and click on these ads. We're even now. I got another one here. This is a once popular internet company. You know, look at where their organic results are on here, what I would consider the content. It's way buried down. I actually cut off a little bit of what was at the top. On my laptop screen, you know, I have this little laptop. Oh, I just spilled my coffee. Okay. But I could use a paper towel, if anyone could grab one. The content's really far down here, and it takes a while to get to. Well, that was awesome. Thank you, Boris.
We just crowdsourced napkins. Nice work.
Now, I got an extreme example of this. This was actually something done by Jeff Veen a little while ago. He went to PC Magazine to look at an article. And this is a little small, so it's hard to see. But this is a screenshot of the entire length of the scrolling of the page. And he's grayed out everything except what he went there to see. Look at that. That's amazing. One of the things he talks about is, you know, when he used to run a magazine and everything, they try to keep a balance of about 60-40 between editorial and advertising. Because presumably people are there for the editorial. Obviously people are not going to PC Magazine for the editorial. So it's things like this that I think are not just not going to scale, you know, as we become smarter, you know. When you think about it, some interesting statistics were released recently about the demographics of people who actually click on ads.
Ooh, go 6%.
And basically what it said is that, you know, advertising, even on affluent websites like the New York Times and everything else, is basically clicked on people with lower incomes, who spend more time online, who have less education. And also, I think TextLink ads can be guilty of this. Not just TextLink ads, but Google's and everything, where the content can be mixed up with the ads a lot, where you're not really clearly discerning between what's content and what's ad, and you might accidentally click an ad. I know if those of you who follow Google's earnings, you might remember on the search page, where we can go back to one of those, you used to be able to click, for example, see where it says tape on that first ad? You could click there. You could actually click to the blank space to the right. They'd make like a block level element where the whole thing was a clickable ad. They recently changed it so you can only click the link. And they found this is, you know, they've registered it in their filings. They said, you know, our earnings are down because, well, when we made it more likely that people meant to click on the ad, we're seeing a lot less. And then we're getting paid per click, not per action. So those types of things change. That's going to be pretty important, I think. Advertising needs to evolve, and our models needs to evolve. And if we think about this respect from the beginning to the end, you know, it's really what it's going to be most effective. Since we're picking on Yahoo, I'd like to keep picking on them. But not just Yahoo. I think my exhortation number three is that we need to kill the mega brands. And it's not going to be, I think the age of portals is over. The fact that, you know, we have Microsoft, Yahoo, and Google as like the three big things in the internet world. It's sort of like back in like, I don't even know when, before I was alive, when we had like three television stations, you know? You had CBS, NBC, and something else. I hear that England still has sort of this kind of, but it's ridiculous. And if you look at how television evolved, which is a broadcast medium, it fragmented into thousands and thousands of channels. Think about how that fragments when the medium's two-way. It's going to be pretty revolutionary, I think. To illustrate this, I did a couple of slides about what if technology brands ran some of the largest brands that we're most familiar with. So this is a Procter & Gamble Purple Laundry Detergent. When you think about it, this is just as ridiculous as Yahoo Mail or Yahoo Sports or Yahoo Launch. You know, why do you put your name in front of everything? Google Square Absorbent Towels Beta. I should have timed this slide with spilling the coffee. That would have been perfect. I'm not going to touch this one. Microsoft Anti-Dangerous Edition 2008 SP1. You know? Yeah. The first version didn't work. Each of these brands I just showed you is a $1 billion business. Procter & Gamble has 23 billion-dollar brands. And each one of those has dozens of sub-brands. So apparently, Head & Shoulders, of the top 30 selling shampoos, Head & Shoulders is 10 of them. Think about that. Apparently, there's 10 different kinds. You know, I showed the Purple Tide because I couldn't find a good picture of the Orange Tide. You know, this is how our websites need to evolve as well. And I think that, you know, examples of where folks have done this, Yahoo's Flickr, Google's YouTube, have been enormously successful because what happens is that people, you know, why we put everything under the single brand, and this is true for any social website, this is true for companies, is because we feel like people know this and they will know this other thing and we'll get some of the good stuff. What you don't realize is people get the bad stuff as well. You know, people don't like using Yahoo because they say, well, that's what my parents set up my email account on. So, you know, the kids are thinking it's not cool. So when Yahoo launches their new Yahoo Live or something, it gets that as negative association, more so than I think that, you know, I think, oh, Yahoo, their mission statement is something like, it's where we engage consumers with advertisers in exciting ways with an exclamation point. Yeah, that's just not compelling. Actually, so if you'd like to read more about this, Dana Boyd actually did a great post, I think this morning or last night, about this. Dana, D-A-N-H, Boyd, B-O-Y-D.
Somebody wiki that, please.
Someone's wikiing right now? In public? That's rude. I think there's fundamental flaws in social software. And I'm going to posit Matt's third law of social media, that unfiltered interaction is worse than useless at scale. I got a great example of this. Remember that, you know, where in the hell is Matt dancing guy we saw earlier? These are the comments on his YouTube. Has anyone ever read the comments on YouTube? I think like it would be a way like taking like 1,000 pills or something. It's like a way to commit mental suicide because it's really, these are actually pretty intelligent for YouTube comments. I didn't make this up, but look at it. It's got 927 comments. Same thing happens on blogs. You ever been to a blog? We host some blogs that do this. We host like some CNN blogs and stuff like this. Thousands and thousands of comments per post. It's just not useful. To be honest, no one's reading them. I don't honestly know why people are still leaving them. I think because there's a text box there, and maybe they're the same people who click on ads. but it's not useful when you think of respecting people's time. Having 927 comments in reverse chronological format under a video It's probably the most disrespectful thing you could do to someone. What YouTube does, which is incredibly respectful, which you have in the corner there, is the related videos. Who's ever gone to YouTube for one video, ended up spending like 30 or 40 minutes there? Yeah. Wow, that's a lot of hands. I didn't even ask you to raise your hands. You people are stretching. Yeah, it's amazing. The first time that I experienced YouTube, I was just blown away because I was like, oh, there goes that afternoon. It's same experience on the Wikipedia, right? When you're like, you go to look up like something about DNS and you end up at 3 in the morning browsing about the Commonwealth of Nations. This is a true story. It's because of the links, right? Wikipedia provides them in sort of an inline way. YouTube uses the tags and traffic patterns and everything to say this is what's related. And it's a really efficient way to spend people's time by showing them if you're interested in this, you're also going to be interested in that. This is why I give, 80% of my paycheck to Amazon because they're so good at knowing what I want. There's an awesome Onion article where it's a wife saying, Amazon knows me better than my husband. He got me a microwave for our anniversary. Amazon said I should get this. Google's respect for people's time was, making the ads clearly distinguished. They had fewer ads than other search engines when they launched. And, you basically almost never go past the first two hits. Think about when you use Google. You're almost always clicking on the first couple of hits. So they say that first-generation social networks are about connections and creating connections for the sake of connections. Friendster is an example of this. LinkedIn is an example of this. Hello, I would like to add you to my professional network. Are you my friend, yes or no? This is first generation stuff. What we've seen in sort of the Web 2.0 world in the past couple of years is people congregating around social objects, which I think is more interesting and can be more compelling for a longer period of time. For YouTube, this is videos. For Delicious, it's tags or links. It's photos on Flickr, Yahoo Answers. One of the people who sort of espouses this is Rajmi Sina, who runs a site called SlideShare. And it's basically YouTube for PowerPoint. It doesn't sound like the most exciting thing, but it's actually pretty compelling because you have a common thing to go around. But what happens is that at scale, this becomes worse and useless because you have what's like the comments on YouTube. Honestly, YouTube could remove the comments tomorrow and no one would be any worse. What would be interesting is because once things get popular, once you have that guy dancing and everyone links to it, you need more filters. You need to say, I don't want to see all the comments. I just want to see the good comments. I just want to see the comments from my friends. I just want to see the comments from people who watched other videos that I watch. There's a lot of ways that you can slice and dice this data, but it needs to be sliced and diced because this is what I think is causing some of the flattening or plateauing of the various social networks that combine around even MySpace, which looks sort of like a generation one, I think is actually sort of a second generation because people will congregate around music and bands. So I think that's where the social media is going. I'd like to sort of finish up by talking about something far more important, which is open source, actually. So all the things that we just talked about are going to be meaningful in the next few years, I think. I could be 100% wrong. But actually, a good exercise I did when I was putting this together was I went back in the archives of my blog, because I've been blogging, I guess, for 5 or 6 years now, which is the longest I've done anything, actually. And it was really funny to me, like, what I used to be really excited about. And really, I used to write posts about, the sale of weblogs.com is killing the open notification web. This was like the largest, most important thing in my life at the time. In the long term, these things kind of just become noise. What I think is more important, and certainly the most compelling idea I've heard in my lifetime, is this idea of open source. There's four freedoms, fundamental freedoms in open source, and I'm actually going to read them because they're really important and a lot of people aren't familiar with them. Freedom zero, the freedom to run the program for any purpose. Freedom one, the geeks wrote this, so they start with zero. I apologize. I didn't write this. Number one, the freedom to study how the program works and adapt it to your needs. Number two, freedom to distribute copies so you can help your neighbor. Number three, the freedom to improve the program and release your improvements to the public so that the whole community benefits. When you think about this, let's step away from software. These were written decades ago. It's incredibly prescient. And honestly, the reason that I think we're all here, and certainly at the very least, the reason WordPress exists, is because of the work that Richard Stallman and these other folks did decades ago, fighting a hard fight and taking an unpopular position against proprietary software. Think about when you apply this to other things in the world, when you apply this to the social networks that you interact with, when you apply this, just look at everything that you do in your life. And how does it impact? I think that also that's, as a corollary to this, the fact that open source software is now becoming consumer prevalent, things like Firefox, Adium, WordPress, other Wikipedia, which is an entirely open source stack and what runs the thing, and open source content, there's a new sort of set of responsibilities. There's a great book called Bowling Alone that talks about sort of the civic decline of the United States and how people, well, the title is from that people used to bowl in groups, they used to do community things, and now they bowl by themselves. It's becoming a lot more isolated. I think there's a new moral imperative that sort of in this technology world that we're privileged enough to have an always-on internet connection, except at conferences usually, to have computers, to have more computing power in this room than all of IBM had in 1980, just on the laptops, so probably on a single laptop. To sort of steal a phrase, ask not what your software can do for you, ask what you can do for your software. And I think that every single person here has the ability to impact an open source project in some sort of way. And ultimately, this is going to be the most important thing in our time. And let me tell you why. Well, first, let me tell you how you can impact an open source software, even though you don't know any code or anything. Well, first, I didn't really know how to code when I started WordPress. Some of you might attest to that fact personally, but but when you look at it, the biggest open source projects don't have problems with code. They have problems with marketing. They have problems with design. They have problems with the whole thing being grayscale. Yesterday, there was a great session at the end where a guy got up. I missed his name, but he was talking about the different WordPress sites that he'd done, and people were giving examples. But what this guy had gone a step further, and he'd written about, he'd taken one of the things that he had done and written about it. And it might have seemed really basic to him, but to thousands of other people, that was a really valuable resource. Here's step-by-step how to turn WordPress into a CMS, and here's what I did with the header, here's what I did with the sidebar, here's what I did with everything. That is what's really scarce now. Now that software is becoming a commodity, that proprietary software in the long term approaches the utility of zero, it's this information. It's the how to use it, how to utilize it most effectively. And that's something anyone in here who writes or takes photos or has done anything can contribute to any open source project. Drupal, WordPress, anything. Why? Because I think that once you have a taste of freedom, it's hard to go back. And this is how we're going to, over the next 10 to 50 years, truly affect change in our society. A great example of this is what's been happening in the enterprise world, actually. Folks like you and me are using something like Basecamp or To-Do-List or something like that in our daily lives. And then we go into our office and we're using the package that someone paid $20 million for, and it sucks. I mean, it's honestly criminal how bad some of this enterprise software is. So what happens? You've had a taste of freedom. You say, we use this thing for $5 a month that works better than our $20 million system. Why? What's the disconnect here? Let's connect the two. And people are talking about the consumerification of the enterprise, where from the bottom up, really, technologies like WordPress, technologies like wikis are really taking over how people interact inside these large companies. How does that apply to other things? So as the general web starts to experience the freedom that comes from maybe running open source software, and even if you move off the service, you still can take all your data and run the same software and keep the same interface. And once you get a taste of that, you kind of want it other places. You want it for your social network. You say, okay, well, Facebook, I'm spending 8 hours a day on it. And I should get something out of that if I want to leave. All these other things. Those are short-term problems. I don't think that as geeks we're, we want to connect all these and we want to tear down the walls, but long-term, the internet always routes around closeness, and I'm not really worried about that. I could have spent 45 minutes talking about how Facebook should be more open with their social graph, but honestly, it wouldn't really matter a couple of years from now, and no one would remember it. What really matters is that we get the fundamental architecture that these things are running on to be an open source system, because those freedoms that we talked about are kind of like the Bill of Rights. When you think about our countries, when you declare independence, it's sort of like forking a government, right? You're saying, this is not right. I have things which are not being addressed, and I demand it to be different. In software, in open source software, you have that right. In almost anything else, you don't often. And those freedoms are going to really, we should demand them. You know, let's move off the online world, which is somewhat trivial, and look at, you know, once you experience the transparency and power of open source, you know, maybe that should apply to the voting systems that determine the fate of our country and many other countries around the world. You know, these are closed systems, proprietary systems. No one can look in it and see how it works. They can't change it. They can't redistribute their changes. These are really important problems. And, you know, even going further, you could apply this to the law itself. What if, you know, the ways that, what if there was a wiki for every bill that's a law? And you could see who made which changes when, and it could be annotated, and you can permalink different changes and different things. I think that sort of transparency would be really powerful. And the way that it's going to happen is not through us, you know, petitioning MySpace or Facebook or any of these closed systems to open up. It's going to be by creating better alternatives. The, you know, if you look at what happened with the music industry, they didn't bounce back by suing their users, by saying bad and slapping you on the wrist and saying, you know, you should really support our business model from a decade ago because we liked making that money. They, by the grace of Steve Jobs, you know, a system was created which was better than piracy. And ultimately, a better product won out. And now that's, you know, that had its limitations, and things like the Amazon MP3 store, I think, are taking that to the next level, which is a good example of a mega brand name, Amazon MP3 store. They're taking these freedoms and sort of applying them to other folks. And that's, you know, that's, we're in a free market, and the best solutions, I do think, win. So we need to create the open alternative. We don't need to sort of lobby. We don't need to create, you know, maybe it's a desktop program that glues all these things together. Maybe it's a web service that's open source and nonprofit, like the Wikipedia, but that can tie everything together. So I think that's how we're ultimately going to win, and that's how we're going to change things. So that's all I got. Ha ha ha.